the Subcommittee on Healthcare Access of the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open an informational meeting on the state of health insurance in Oregon. And we'll have Corey Streisinger and Joel Aereo join us, please. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having us here.
Do we have the copies of the report distributed to the committee, Dina?
Sorry, do we have the copies of the reports?
Yes. Yeah, I want there, right?
Yes. Wonderful. Mr. Chair, thank you for having us here today to talk about our report on health insurance in Oregon. And this, we know, fits into a much larger context that you'll be spending a lot of time here. Oh, and I'm sorry, for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is Joel Aereo, Administrator of the Insurance Division. And we know you're going to be spending a lot of time on the big picture of health care in Oregon. And private health insurance is only one component of that. It is not the same as health care, and the issues that we address here are only a small part of the discussion. But nevertheless, private health insurance is an important part of our health care system in Oregon. So we want to make sure that you as policymakers and members of the public had access to good information about what the health insurance market looks like, and what we regulate and what we don't, and what some of the numbers are here in Oregon. And just to give you a little bit of history, the last session, Senate Bill 501, which went through several different iterations, came out as a bill requiring additional reporting to us by health insurers on insurers' financial performance in specific market segments. And, you know, there's a tendency to say, well, okay, that's a bill that requires reports. The reports go sit on a shelf. And we felt it was important, actually, to use these reports to provide useful information. We already have and had for a long time quite a bit of information about health insurance.
Okay. Can we hold conversations in the back of the room, please? Stick it outside if you need to talk. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have had information about quite a bit of the health insurance market for quite some time. The Senate Bill 501 information expanded our information by allowing us to look at different market segments in a new way. And in addition, I don't think we'd ever collected the data and presented it in quite this way before. As well as we found there really wasn't any single source, any single place to look to understand how the regulation of health insurance works in Oregon. So we tried to do that as well. We do have recommendations in this report, which we'd like to talk to you about, but a primary purpose of the report, over and above the recommendations, is to provide the type of information that I just mentioned. So we would like to go through it briefly today. I will discuss health insurance in general and what we regulate and how. Joel's going to review some of the data about the specific insurers and the marketplace. I'm going to talk about some cost containment issues, and then we will both talk about the recommendations. And I do first want to make a couple of general points. I think we're all familiar with the rising costs of health insurance. I'm not going to go through the data, although you will find some of the data on pages 2 and 3 of the report. But one point to note is that the cost of health insurance premiums, have consistently exceeded inflation, have exceeded growth in wages, or any of the other measures that we usually use to look at the costs of things. And in addition to those increases in the cost of health insurance premiums, the actual costs paid by people who have health insurance has continued to increase as well. That is, health insurance has continued to shift additional costs to the individual insured in the form of increased copays and deductibles. So just looking at the cost of increases in health insurance premiums doesn't actually tell the full picture of what an individual Oregonian is experiencing. Our focus today is on health insurance, but it is worth keeping in mind that many of the drivers of those increases in health insurance costs are the same as drivers for increases in health care costs generally. And our report does not go into those in detail. You have many other sources of those. We cited some of the sources in the report, but obviously things like medical inflation, increases in utilization, new medical technologies, increases in prescription drug usage, and just general aging and unhealthiness of the population all drive health insurance costs as they drive health care costs in general. There is one specific point to note about health insurance, though, and that is that health insurance premiums also do reflect a cost shift. And whether it's from the uninsured's use of hospital services, which are not reimbursed, or whether it's through the setting of reimbursement rates for Medicare and Medicaid, often the private health insurance market is the sector of the health insurance industry, the people who are paying the bills, who actually can pay more than those uncontrollable by the provider aspects of health care costs. So we do see a cost shift, and I think some of the studies show that as much as $1,000 to $1,400 of what a family will pay for health care coverage over the course of a year represents the cost of those cost-shifted items. So with those are some caveats to keep in mind as we talk about health insurance in general. When we talk about health insurance, what are we talking about? About 60% of Oregonians have private health care coverage. And I'm using the word coverage rather than insurance because that actually consists of two different components, health insurance and self-insured coverage provided by large employers. Now, if we look at that 60%, and the remainder of Oregonians either have Medicare or Medicaid coverage, or, of course, 17% are uninsured. But if we look at the 60% who have private health care coverage, about one-third of that is, in fact, provided by large employers who self-insure. And although that, to the individual employee, may look and feel a lot like health insurance, in fact, from a regulatory standpoint, it's quite different, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So about two-thirds, roughly 40% of Oregonians, have actually purchased commercial health insurance, and that could be group coverage through generally their employer or individual coverage. The individual market is pretty small, 6 or 7%, roughly speaking. So most coverage in Oregon is group coverage, and most of it is large group. And if you think about it, that makes sense for a couple of reasons. Large employers employ more Oregonians than small employers, and in addition, large employers are much more likely to provide health insurance.
That's not precisely true.
Mr. Chair, not if we look at employment in general, but on a per-employer basis, excuse me. So one 500-person employer providing health coverage outweighs quite a number of two or three employee employers providing health care coverage. If you look at the chart that's on page 4 of the report, you'll see how it breaks out by size of employer. And you'll see that there really are significant differences, and again, it's common sense. Large employers generally do provide at least employee-only coverage, often coverage for families and part-time employees as well, while when we're dealing with the smaller employers, it's much more difficult to provide coverage. Let me go back to self-insurance for a moment. Oh, and I should point out, if you want to look at how the numbers break out, we did provide a chart on page 8, which is our best estimates, and I want to stress some of these are solid numbers, some of them are estimates, about how people in Oregon get health care coverage, or in case of the uninsured, do not have health care coverage. So this gives you the size of each of the market segments that we're going to be talking about. And as you can see, large group, roughly speaking, about 25% of Oregonians. So, and interestingly, the part that we regulate most, and I'll get into that in a minute, is not large group. It's the individual and small group. Very important market segments, but together not nearly as large as that larger group segment. You'll also see, then, the estimated number of self-insured, and that is the large employers who self-insure, meaning that they bear the risk of their employees' health care costs. They may use a third-party administrator, which are often the same as health insurance companies. Many of them provide third-party administration services. So from the employee standpoint, they have a Regents card or a Providence card in their pocket, and it works just the same way as insurance. But it is not insurance. That insurance company is providing administrative services, claims handling services, but not risk transfer. What that means for us is that it's not subject to state regulation for the most part. ERISA preempts states from regulating these self-insured plans.
Can you explain what ERISA is, please?
Mr. Chair, I know I'm not supposed to use acronyms, so let me see if I can do this one. Employee Retirement
Insurance
Security Act. I'm hearing a lot of help from the audience. And it is the federal statute that regulates employee benefits, generally speaking, and it does preempt state regulation in a number of those areas. So that has been one of the interesting issues that we deal with when we talk about, for example, insurance mandates. Those mandates apply to insurance, but not to those self-insured plans. So we sometimes, for example, get calls from someone saying, how come my insurance doesn't provide X? The mental health parity bill that was passed by the last legislative session, how come my insurance doesn't provide that? Well, often the answer is because you don't actually technically have insurance. What you have is employer-provided coverage. So moving to insurance then, it does break down into four market segments primarily: individual, small group, medium-sized group, and large group. And small group is 2 to 25 employees.
Can I have a question, Chair?
Please.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Can you go back? You said the statement so that if a person has coverage by an employer, they don't have insurance.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, if they have coverage through a large employer that self-insures, they do not have insurance from a regulatory standpoint. So if you are a large employer...
Okay, I think I got the difference right there.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
And the difference is the risk transferred to the insurance company.
Right, okay, got it. Thank you.
So the market segments: individual, small group, which is 2 to 25 employees, medium-sized groups, which is 26 to 50, and large group, which is 51 and up. And as I mentioned, most Oregonians who have this private health coverage are in large groups. For all of these market segments, there are some areas where we enforce consistent regulations. We regulate financial solvency, for example, with respect to all insurance companies, not just health insurance companies, incidentally, but certainly health insurance companies as well. And solvency is one of our key focus areas, because for someone who buys insurance, obviously a critical issue for them is that the insurance company is going to be able to pay claims if and when they have a health need. And so we, as all states, apply standards to measure financial solvency. We examine those insurance companies' financial records, and we ensure that they keep enough capital and what's called surplus, in addition to their reserves, to ensure that not only can they pay claims, but that they have a cushion that will allow them to pay claims in the future. And generally speaking, the formula for calculating financial solvency, and Joel will get into some of this a little later when we talk about the profiles of our insurers, it's a formula that looks at a number of different factors and comes up with a ratio which is called a risk-based capital, or RBC ratio. And so you will see references in the report to RBC levels. And generally speaking, a company must have, in order to do business and not be closed down, an RBC ratio of at least 100. But in order to stay out of regulatory trouble, they have to have at least 200. And if they slip below 200, we will be in with them taking regulatory action. 200 is a bare minimum. A company that has an RBC level of 200 is not in healthy financial shape. So ratios above that are what we typically see, and that could be 300, 400, and you'll see other RBC ratio percentages in here. So that is one thing we do, is we monitor financial solvency of insurance companies. But something else we do across the board is we enforce consumer protection laws, and we assist consumers with insurance problems. So we look to make sure that insurance companies are, in fact, following the law. We examine policy forms before they can be sold in Oregon to make sure that they contain required provisions, that they comply with the mandate provisions, for example. We look at how claims are handled, we investigate complaints, and we have a consumer advocacy staff, again, not just in health insurance, but across the board, that assists individual consumers with health care, with insurance problems, to resolve problems. And we use that not only to identify problems and help individual consumers, but also to identify then trends and broader issues that we may need to address from a regulatory standpoint or that we may need to bring to your attention as policymakers. So that consumer protection function, again, is across the board for all of this commercial health insurance. We also regulate rates, but only for the individual and small group markets. And that's a key. The individual and small group markets have some other characteristics as well. And before I get to them, I should mention the medium-sized groups, the 26 to 50 groups, are very similar to large groups in terms of the regulatory structure. We do not regulate rates, but they are similar to small groups in one respect, and that is that we do have what's called guaranteed issue for small and medium-sized groups, which means that any employer in that category can buy insurance from any insurance company offering it. An employer group cannot be turned down because of the health condition or the age of their employees. That is a very important protection for Oregonians because we would not want to see a situation where a small employer who happened to have older employees or employees who were unhealthy became unable to buy insurance. We also have, in the small group market, the 2 to 25 market, pooled, essentially community rating, so that, again, a small employer's rates do not vary based on the health condition of their employees. Now, those rates can vary to a certain extent based on the age of their employees. The current rate band is 2.5 to 1. So the employer with older employees can't be charged more than 2.5 times what the least expensive would be. But the rates don't vary based on health condition for small groups. That is also true with the individual market. Individual health insurance is now, in individual health insurance, you can be turned down because of your health condition. Not with small groups, but an individual can be turned down because of their health history. But if they are accepted, they get a pooled rate, and they, although it can vary much more broadly based on age, and they also get guaranteed renewability, so that once you're accepted, as long as that health insurance company is still in that business of offering those policies, if you get sick, you can't be canceled based on the fact that you got sick. So those are some of the protections that we have in this market for individuals and for small groups. In terms of how we regulate rates, there are a number of factors that we take into account. And one of the things, of course, that we do is we look at whether the rate is justifiable. But another thing that we do is we look at whether there's discrimination among categories. We make sure that the rate is distributed fairly and appropriately based on actuarial factors among the different classes and ages and sizes of the insureds. So in terms of the factors we look at, we have an actuarial standard in Oregon, and rates must be fair in relationship to the benefits charged. And if you want to look at page 11 of the report in the right-hand column, the top, the language is there. The filings cannot be prejudicial to the interest of the insured's policyholders. The benefits must be reasonable in relationship to the premium charged, and the filings can't contain provisions which are unjust, unfair, or inequitable. So very broad language. What we generally take into account is projected loss ratios, and Joel's going to get into what some of these terms mean, historical and projected loss ratios, historical and projected trend, historical and projected administrative costs, and then a net income target for those insurers. And one of our recommendations, which we'll talk about a little later, has to do with some suggestions about how to handle those rating factors and whether those rating factors should be expanded.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Richardson.
And Corey, will you also be dealing with the issue of reserves, the amounts of reserves that nonprofits have and the appropriateness of, you know, how large is enough and when is too much or enough so that a nonprofit might be encouraged to utilize some of those reserves for those that they're have their mission to serve.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, that is a great segue to turning this over to Joel, who's going to talk about exactly that issue.
Great, thank you.
Can I ask one question before that? Does anybody else have any questions of Corey before we move on? Why do you only regulate the small and the medium group, the individual and the small and not the medium and the large?
Mr. Chair, and that too is an interesting question, and there's a number of reasons. I mean, I could say because that's what the legislature has told us.
Is that the basic reason?
That is what the statutes currently say, and one of our recommendations actually is going to address the 26 to 50 market. But there are actually some other answers to that, and they're particularly with respect to the large groups, really twofold. One of them, maybe threefold. One of them is because self-insurance is an option. And when you're getting to a large group, really the rates are experience-based to the extent, especially for very large groups, that it's really not that dissimilar from self-insurance. That is, it will be individually tailored to that large group's experience, and the experience will be pooled. It's big enough to be a pool in and of itself so that there's less risk of I have an unhealthy employee and therefore I pay more. And the next factor that relates to large groups, of course, is they have more negotiating power. And so large employers do, in fact, tend to negotiate rates, and plans can be tailored to a specific employer. So for the individual and small group market, the plans are fairly standardized. An insurer may offer a broad range of them, but they're plans that exist on the market. For a large group, they can actually tailor the benefits specifically to the desires of that employer to emphasize this over that, to have a particular benefit structure. The issue of purchasing power, the issue of being large enough to be your own pool, and the issue of having self-insurance as an option are the primary distinguishing factors.
You won't be surprised to hear there's a proposal to have you regulate across the range.
Good question.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, Corey, I looked through this, and I've read most of it. Before I came, but I'm also just kind of reviewing it now. But I don't see anything relating to benchmarks with other states. Can you tell us if you have seen if there has been similar reports or information gathered from, like, Washington, and how, you know, our prices in our state compare with them? Because I see the spread for the average cost for an individual from small groups, medium groups, and large groups, all it's just within $6, from $237 to $243. And so I'm just wondering, how do we compare with our adjacent states?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'm going to ask Joel to take that one, if I could.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we don't have any simple comparisons because a lot depends on what the benefit structure is in each state, what the regulatory structure is, and so forth. But in very broad...
You represent, would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the administrator with the insurance division within DCBS.
I'm sorry. Would you please...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson. So there aren't any easy comparisons to make because the benefit structures can be different, the regulatory requirements can be different depending on whether it's guaranteed issue, those sorts of things. So there's always going to be variation, but in very broad strokes, the Oregon market is generally below average nationally in terms of prices, but is increasing in price in the last few years. So when benefit surveys are done nationally, it does show an upward tick in Oregon. We're catching up with the rest of the country, and I think in some categories we may be above average now in terms of premium costs. One of the issues here that comes up in the Medicare discussions and other discussions is that because we invested heavily in managed care in this state early on in the 1990s, we were a pretty efficient state, very efficient at hospital utilization and that sort of thing. Kind of then we got punished on the Medicare rates because they're set based on where your market was. So at that time, we were lower than average, but we've been catching up.
And would you like to answer Representative Richardson's question on reserves, or do you want to put that in this context?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, the bottom line answer to your question is on page 20 of the report, but if you'll indulge me, I can kind of work up to page 20 through a set of earlier pages. So I'll go into that now. I guess my role here is to talk to the insurance, talk of the numbers, what is our market like, who are the carriers in the market, how are they doing financially, what are prices like in each of the individual market segments. So I'm going to start with some general comments about the big picture of our health insurance market and then work my way to some of the individual market segments. And, you know, it's kind of nerdish to get into all these numbers, and I'll try to keep it as interesting as I can and use some visual aids here. So the first point I'd make about the insurance, health insurance marketplace in Oregon is that it is a competitive one. If you turn to page 17 in the report, you'll see there that there are 8 insurers in Oregon, all of whom are domestic insurers in Oregon, means that they're home base of businesses here in Oregon that dominate our market. Those 8 companies together account for 3.9 out of the 4.3 billion in health insurance premiums, which were earned in the market segments we're talking about in 2005. Now, this doesn't include some other business. Most of these carriers have other business enterprises too, Medicare business, self-insured business, and so forth. But in the regulated markets that we're talking about today, these are the numbers. And you'll see there are two that dominate up around $1 billion in premium, and that's Regions, which is the Blue Cross plan here in Oregon, and Kaiser. And then there are 4 more that are in the $400 billion range, so still quite large health insurers. And then the last 2 in the top 8 are down around $100 billion. If you look at that second pie chart below, you see what I mean about a competitive market. Very large insurers that Kaiser and Regents are crossing the billion mark, but the rest of them are in the 400 million range, excuse me. The pie chart then will show you what percentage of the market each of these carriers have, and you'll see that, again, Regents and Kaiser are around 25% of the market, and then we have 4 other insurers around 10%. I don't know for sure, but I don't believe there are any states that have as many insurers with that sized market segment. Typically, in most states, the Blue Cross plan or some other single large insurer that's been around for a long time has a dominant position. And then there are other states like Washington where there are 3 insurers that pretty much dominate the market. But we have 8 and 6 in particular that are very significant players, and depending on the market segment, sometimes the dominant carrier in a particular market. So we start with a very competitive market. Here, the insurance industry is profitable today in Oregon, and if you turn to page 19, you'll get a feel for that. The two charts there you have first at the top is the summary of the 10-year profitability, and you'll note that over the 10-year period, the average profitability is 2%, so that's a pretty reasonable range in most people's minds. But if you look down to the bottom chart, you'll see that the profitability has been increasing pretty steeply in the last 5 years. So in for the 5-year period, it would be 3% on average, but if you look at particular carriers, Providence is up at 8% for the 5-year, 8% in 2006, 9% in 2005, Pacific Source at 7%, the average of the 8 is at 5% for 2005. So profit levels are clearly increasing. That is one of the reasons we did this report, in addition to having this 501 data. Corey and I went around and talked to all the health insurers about these levels of profitability. They clearly are increasing. However, it's important to note that one of the things we heard almost from every insurer was, you guys are here today complaining about high levels of profitability, but we have to tell you that your predecessors were here only 5, 6, 7 years ago complaining about not enough money and potential solvency problems. And if you look at that top chart again, you'll see that that's demonstrated there for the 1996 to 2000 period. 3 of the carriers were actually in the red, HealthNet, ODS, and Providence, and the rest were 0-1, and a couple were at 2%. So it is true that today profitability levels are up, but it's also true that for most of the carriers they were down, significantly down in the previous 5-year period, and that kind of gets to what's true of the health insurance market as well as true of most insurance markets, which they're like the economy, they're cyclical. And so you'll hear from the insurers that we're at the top of the cycle. No one knows where the top of the cycle is exactly when it's going to start to go down. down, although there's been some decrease in the beginning parts of 2006 if you look at the numbers. But the overall picture, 10-year picture, 2% profitability, but shorter term, increasing and higher levels of profitability, which have caught the attention of us as well as a lot of other folks. Now, if we look more deeply into the numbers, again, bear with me and go to page 20, and this Representative Richardson comes back to your question. As that profitability has increased, you'll see that the surplus of these carriers has increased. Now, you mentioned reserves, too. Reserves are a separate issue. That's what the carriers are reserving against claims that have already been incurred and what they think ultimately will be the payout. On top of that is the surplus in case those reserves aren't right or in case some other events happen. And there are a lot of things that can happen in the health insurance business to make profitability go south in a hurry. But if you look at those numbers, you'll see the graphic demonstration. Everybody except Pacific Care has increased its surplus in the last 5 years, and some of them have increased it double, even triple, in the last 5 years. So again, that's cause for Corey and I to go around and talk to the health insurers about some of these, issues. So that's the surplus picture. Another issue that's important and that probably, if you had to pick one.
Excuse me, Joe. Anybody else wants to interrupt at any time, please do. Joe, I'm not sure what the reserve is in that case. I think Kaiser in 2005. That's $359 million, is that?
Yes.
Out of a $1 billion budget?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Their premium earned was about $1 billion, and their surplus at that point is about $360 million.
No, because the premium base you have, that billion, doesn't include Medicare and other things. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that is right. Going back to my original comment, that surplus is against their whole line of business, which is larger than the $1
billion. I think it's closer to $8 billion.
Okay.
Anyway,
okay.
I'm sorry. It's not a 35% surplus, so it's a little problem comparing that to the one on page 17.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Whenever you start comparing numbers, there are always caveats and qualifications, and so that's it. Correct, that there is a lot more business, self-insured, Medicare, and so forth. Probably the single most important component that goes into whether an insurance company is profitable, a health insurance company is profitable or not profitable, is...
Can I interrupt? Just follow up. That also doesn't include medium and large groups then either.
Mr. Chair, it does include the groups that are represented in the report. So it would be the individual market, small group market, medium group market, and large group market.
Even though those others aren't regulated.
Mr. Chair, for financial solvency purposes, they are regulated.
Okay.
All of their, and in fact, even the Medicare business is regulated by us for solvency, but the numbers don't show up here.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 501 gave us this data in terms of market segments for the unregulated segments.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. To move on to the next chart, which is what is the single most important component that goes into determining whether a company is profitable and building surplus or not profitable and losing surplus is the medical loss ratio, and that's on page 21 of the report. And what that means, what a medical loss ratio is for every dollar that comes in premium, how much of that dollar goes out to pay claims. And in general terms, a good marker in the health insurance market is that 80% of the money, or 80 cents on the dollar, should go out, at least that much should go out in claims payments. The rest of it then would be administrative costs, investment income, and taxes, and then either profit or loss. So if you look at the numbers here, you'll see that if you take the averages, they're the last column. Each of our insurers was in the 80 to 90% range for the five-year period from 2001 to 2005. But one interesting trend to notice there is that the for-profit insurers, and there are, I should have mentioned earlier, there are four of our largest eight insurers. The three largest and one more of the top eight are nonprofits. That would be Regents, Kaiser, Pacific Source, the three largest, plus Providence. The other four are for-profits. And if you look at this chart, The two that have the lowest loss ratios, in other words, pay out the least per dollar of premium, are two of the largest for-profits, which are HealthNet and LifeWise at 81%. And then you have, at the other end, Regions, the largest insurer, at 87%. And you have Kaiser up to 95%. Now, Kaiser looks a little better than they is fair to them, and that's where the numbers always have complication to them. But Kaiser, because it's a rather unique, integrated medical system that Chair is well familiar with, it tends to put some costs that other carriers would call administrative costs go into the claims costs, and so their number for loss ratio is artificially high for that reason. But those are some numbers on the loss ratios, and that's oftentimes what consumers ask about: is how much of my premium dollar comes back in claims costs to me, or to on average to the consumers. So that's on medical loss ratios.
Great question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is just: what are some of the ways that insurance companies affect bring this number up or down? What are some of the major factors involved in shifting this number?
Well, it would start at the macro level with Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon. It would start at the macro level with how well their actuaries project claims costs into the future. So they start each year with targets, loss ratios, and they try to project what they think claims will be, and that has a major impact on these costs. Then once they're into the year, the kinds of things that would affect whether they have a good year or a bad year, it's going to be some of the you know, how many big claims they have, that sort of thing, but also how much their kind of medical management tools affect utilization, how successful they are at managing the most expensive cases. That's a very, Corey's going to talk about that in a few minutes, but all the insurers today will tell you that effective management of the chronic cases, of the serious diseases, are very important, because health insurance is like most types of insurance, maybe even more extreme than most, in that a small number of people drive most of the claims costs in any given year. So managing those, that the high-end users of the system effectively, is a very important aspect, and other kinds of management tools like that. Mr. Chair, there could be that problem too. That's where our consumer protection mission comes in. I'll now turn very briefly to a couple points about the individual market segments before turning it back over to Corey. And so I'm going to just...
Yes, sir. Were you going to get to my question?
Reserves
and nonprofits, the size of reserves and utilization, surpluses, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, thank you for reminding me. I did show you. Let's go back to page 20. And so you do see that those reserves have substantially increased, and that was surplus has substantially increased, and that was one of the focal points that Corey and I engaged in dialogue with the carriers on. There's a basic requirement in health insurance in all lines of insurance, and this is covered in Chapter 2 of the report, to have at least 200% of what's called the risk-based capital standards as surplus. So that's a baseline, and you see that. That's actually not in this chart, but if you looked at the individual carriers later in the chart, you'd see where they are against their baseline. They're all above that baseline. So the first point for a regulator is the surplus must be at least to that baseline. Now, your question is, how much above that baseline is too much? There is no easy answer to that question. We've looked at what other states have done with it. A couple have gotten into the question of whether there should be some maximum surplus that's allowed, and the surplus above that should be prohibited or confiscated or something like that. The only state
I think it's utilized, not confiscated.
Utilized. Utilized for the public good.
Can you get where you sit in this whole...
That's very true. The state that's looked at that most thoroughly is Pennsylvania, and they have they had been in discussion about having some level, and I believe the level that they eventually settled on was at 550% RBC, which is about triple the minimum, that there would be no profit margin allowed in rate filings, and at 750% there would be no rate increases of any sort allowed. And that never did go into effect, because about the time it was to go into effect, there was, surprise of all surprises, an arrangement, a deal between the governor and some of the large carriers to contribute into some fund to deal with the problem of affordability of insurance for people who didn't have insurance. So those discussions have taken place in some states, Pennsylvania. Washington at one point issued an RFP over that issue. But if you talk to insurance regulators around the country, and it would certainly be my view, the idea of trying to set a maximum is probably not as good a solution as trying to have an effective rate regulation system and make sure that the rates are really fair and effective rates. So the answer is nobody's yet come up with a particular definition that's been proven workable of above this level, we are going to utilize the surplus for other purposes.
Sure. Just a comment, and that is sometimes in the business world, we seem to forget that there is a difference between profit-making corporations and nonprofits, and the mission statement of a nonprofit. And since that mission statement is, you know, for the good of the community and so forth, I would think that we ought to just bring out on the table that if you have a nonprofit that has a huge amount of surplus, then possibly we ought to get some idea from them on how they're going to utilize that to accomplish their mission.
Yeah, and we are going to hear, I suspect, in this committee yet a bill on that issue for nonprofit hospitals. I think they're going to propose something around that as well. I think it's absolutely right. We ought to be looking at that. That's
Mr. Chair, I could mention, and Representative Richardson, a couple other points on this, which are that after our discussions, and whether it was coincidental or not, some of the carriers have taken rate decreases, and those, some of those surpluses are coming down. The most notable would be Regents, our largest carrier in the individual market, took a 16% rate cut on July 1st of this year. Providence, which shows up here as one of the most profitable, entered the individual market. They had not been in the individual market. They considered it too risky a market for them, but at their profitability level, they chose to go in, and they took a 9% rate decrease in November of this year. So we are seeing the kind of thing that you'd want to see in a competitive market, some market responses, some decreases in rates just through the market mechanisms, plus a little bit of what I'd call good old-fashioned jawboning around these issues as well.
What's it 200% of?
The 200% is a risk-based capital formula, and there's a minimum requirement in the state, which is a couple, like $5 million for most insurers now. So the real operative principle is this risk-based capital formula, which takes into account the volume of business, the volatility of that line of business, the kinds of investments the company has, and a number of complicated factors like that to set a number that's individualized to their particular risk profile. And then the system is set up so that at 200% or below, we have to get involved. And at 100%, we end up having to take over the company. And
Mr. Chair, if I could, we give a short description of risk-based capital on page 10 of the report. And one complicating factor is that it is not an arithmetic ratio. So you cannot say 200% is so many dollars, 400% is twice that. Unfortunately, it is an algorithm that does not subject itself to that type of analysis. What we have done is given you charts of the individual insurers, which you'll find in the individual profile sections. If you look, just as an example, at page 42, you will see Regents' RBC chart, surplus chart. And in each of these charts, and you'll see the same formula for each insurer, the lower line is that minimum level, the 200% level. The upper line is the actual surplus.
Is that a black box? Or is that
it is a black box, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I have just got more comments which relate to the individual market segments. And so I'll talk through briefly the individual market. If you look at page 28 of the report, page 27 shows you the market shares there. You'll see that there's a competitive market there. And then page 28 shows you the average premiums for each of the companies. You'll see that the average premium in the individual market is $180. Now, I should also note here, average premium per member per month is the form in which the data came into us. A more common formulation is the average premium, which takes into account dependents and families as units, and those numbers are generally about $100 higher than the numbers we're talking about here. This is just purely taking the total number of people, individuals, family dependents, spouses, and so forth, and dividing, treating them each as one unit. So the numbers are lower than it would be if you were dealing with the kind of employer benefit surveys that, for instance, we were talking about before. But $180 per member per month is the average in this market, and you'll see quite a bit of variation between the plans. Kaiser and Pacific Care higher than most because, again, they offer richer benefit plans, more managed care type plans. Some of the other carriers offer more of the high deductible, higher cost sharing types of plans. We did talk about the Regents and Providence in this market have taken rate reductions in the last year. These numbers don't reflect that because these are 2005 numbers. If you look to pages 30 and 31 of the report, you'll see the average premiums, and again, Representative Richardson already referenced this, that for group markets, the average premiums are remarkably close. So it's $241 in the small group market, and then if you go to pages 36 and 37, it's $237 average per member per month premiums in the medium group market. And then if you go to a large group, it's $251. So generally the same. Last comment I'll make on that is somebody looking at that, thinking that this has all been normalized to make it standard or so you can measure across markets would say, gee, why are the large group premiums the highest of anybody? That illustrates the fact that these numbers depend a lot on what the benefit structures are in each of these markets, and the large group market is higher average premium, probably not because they actually get less bang for the buck in that marketplace. They probably get better bang for the buck, but the benefits are generally richer in that market, so it illustrates some of the difficulty of comparing across market segments. With that, I'll turn it back to Director Streisinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And obviously, there's a lot of data in here that we're not going through with you, but we will be happy to answer questions about any of the data, either now or individually afterwards. I do want to spend a little time talking about some of the cost containment initiatives that we became aware of through this process. And this is Section 6 of the report, which begins on page 65. As Joel mentioned, one of the things we did in preparing this report was not just review the data that we had, but we visited with the top management teams of most of the large insurers to talk about what they were seeing, what their numbers looked like, but also what they were doing to be not just a passive pass-through of costs, but actually to use their market power to help control health care costs and keep premium levels down. And what we found is that there are a lot of initiatives underway and a lot more under consideration in the health insurance industry. And, of course, these are important to all of us, not just within health insurance, but as we look across the health care spectrum. So we just wanted to mention a few of these, and then we'll come back to some thoughts on this when we talk about our recommendations. A lot of these will be very familiar to you because they are the same issues that we deal with in other segments of healthcare industry. One of the ones that almost all...
Excuse me, Madam Director. It would be good if we can tie this up by 4 o'clock.
Mr. Chair will be happy to do that,
then we can move into the hearing on one of your bills, which I assume you'll be testifying on as well.
You're correct, Mr. Chair. So in that case, I'll just spend a moment on these initiatives because many of them you're undoubtedly familiar with in other contexts. Things like prescription drug formularies to encourage the use of generics and more cost-effective drugs. Things like prior authorization or at least justification requirements. case and disease management, which Joel mentioned, because, as I think we're all familiar with some of the numbers on page 66, a very small percentage of the population with the most serious health conditions drive a large percentage of the cost. And we did hear about some of these programs which have proved effective in reducing hospital days, for example. Some of the wellness initiatives focusing on lifestyle issues, subsidization of whether it's health club memberships or self-education. One of the areas which we will talk about in a little more detail in particular when we get into the bill is transparency, making more information available to consumers to make good choices. Some insurers are looking at provider pay for performance and actually things like use of best practice protocols by providers, compensation for example, making sure that a diabetes patient gets particular screenings and particular procedures in accordance with some best practice guidelines. So, I'm, again, not going to go through these in detail because you are probably quite familiar with them, but we were encouraged by the extent to which our private health insurers are engaged in exploring those activities.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Corey, I think you just made an assumption that may not be accurate. I think we have some new members sitting at this dais, and I know myself, I didn't sit on these committees, so I wouldn't even myself be as familiar with these issues. So don't, please don't presume that we are as familiar with this subject matter as you would be. Go a little slower. It's okay, because I think there's a lot of information here.
Mr. Chair?
I very much appreciate that.
Yeah, one of the fallibilities, as I've heard people testify, you assume we know as much as you do, and clearly we don't, as it pertains to this issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'm always afraid that we're going into too much detail, and it's hard to strike that balance. So on some of these, I mentioned the prescription drug one. Let me just talk about a couple of them briefly then. The prescription drug one, the tiered pricing, those of us who are PEB members are familiar with it, of course. It doesn't take away the doctor's ability to prescribe and the patient's ability to choose, but what it does do is it says in most cases, if there are equally effective drugs, we are going to have a preferred drug list for which we will pay a higher amount. And if you choose to get, for example, a brand name drug when we believe there is a generic drug that is clinically equivalent, as cost effective, we will pay less and you will pay more for that choice of a brand name drug. So that's one management tool that a lot of health insurance companies have very successfully used to move people toward generic drugs that are clinically equivalent or as effective. And there's a lot of work being done on developing those types of studies that show in which drug categories there's equivalence. So that's one technique. The case management and disease management, for people with those potentially high-cost conditions, whether it is diabetes or coronary artery disease or even something like asthma, very often there's a huge payoff in getting the physician and the patient to comply with some specific protocols about testing, about checking different levels of blood sugar on a regular basis, about counseling. And so having a protocol that incents the physician and incents the patient to participate in those types of screenings, types of education and self-management, in some cases can have very significant payoff. And so many insurance companies do use chronic case management, disease management. They may have a nurse advice line, for example. They may contact the patient regularly to make sure that they're taking their medications or that they don't have, that there aren't questions or that they're complying with the recommended treatment protocols. It's not a set of requirements. It's assistance for the patient in ways that they have found often helps manage these chronic conditions.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Chair. Real quickly on case care and disease management, I've heard different varying kind of research that sometimes they don't really see a cost saving. There's better access. I mean, this is old data. Are we actually seeing better, more cost savings with that versus just better access?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bacobian, we heard mixed results. We heard some insurers say we don't see any cost savings, but these are things which produce some better health, even though they don't produce cost savings. We heard some other insurers say this is something that purchasers are demanding. They want it, so we provide it because they want it. We did hear some insurers, and you may want to hear from them later in the session, come in and say this works, and it saves hospital days, and it saves cost, and it produces much better health outcomes. So there is a spectrum, but we were actually encouraged by some of the health insurers' examples that were showed very specific results, and we asked for numbers, and we saw the numbers. Transparency we're going to talk about when we talk about the bill, so I'm not going to go over that in great detail right now. The pay-for-performance one, this is one that's it's controversial, and it's insurers reported some interesting thoughts about this. Some of them are just thinking about it, but again, some of them have moved, and sometimes in other states, toward actually paying specifically for a provider complying with particular protocols. That's one that I think we will hear more about as insurers get more heavily into that area. Now, there have been also some examples, and again, we were told one insurer in one other state where they moved in that direction, and it was not at all a success and created a heavy pushback from physicians. So it's an area where I would say we're at the beginning stages, but there are insurers who are exploring it. Prior authorization was a popular technique back quite a while ago when managed care was a lot more present on the horizon, and it got a bad name. But a number of insurers are exploring, particularly for things like diagnostic screenings, MRI types of screenings, saying that we want the physician to ask us ahead of time before they go ahead with the procedure. What they have found is they don't turn down any of the requests, but they get a whole lot fewer requests by the requirement to ask. And so it influences behavior simply by having the requirement in place to request authorization for some of the quite high-priced areas of growth like diagnostic imaging.
There's that ICE and studies where it works even if you have to call a phone that takes a recorded message and give your justification into the recorder, it still shuts down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we found that very interesting. So those are some of the tools that insurers are exploring. And with that, unless there are more questions, I would like to move into the recommendations, being mindful of our time here. And
are there any questions? Let me know.
The first couple, Mr. Chair, can I just ask one question?
And I'll be quiet.
Right, you made a statement, and it's kind of. You talked about you regulate the individuals and the smalls, but not the mediums or the larges. Is there a reason, you said because the legislature told you you didn't have to do that, but is there a problem now is there a concern now that the larges need to be regulated, or is there a problem, is there a market issue, or what's worked now, what's not working anymore?
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, with respect to the large groups, we are not proposing ourselves, although other people may be, extending rate regulation to the large groups. Those tend to be individually negotiated and tailored plans. From our perspective, the area where we are proposing some change is with the middle-sized groups, the 26 to 50-sized groups. And that is an area where it is the issue is how do we ensure that insurance is affordable to those who may have the sicker and older workers. And right now those rates are not regulated. In the small group market they are, and we have that pooling issue where all small employers are able to buy health insurance at the pooled rates. Expanding that pool to the 26 to 50 sized market would, first of all, expand the size of the pool, which generally strengthens the pool, but it would mean that those middle-sized employers, there are always winners and losers. So the employers with young and healthy workers would not benefit from extending rate regulation to that group. They would, in fact, ultimately pay potentially more. But for those who find insurance unaffordable now, we have the potential to make it more affordable for them. So the issue is, in my mind, one of pooling, and how do we get the benefits of pooling for those middle-sized groups. Now, there is a separate issue about profitability, and a rate regulation can and does also look at that issue of whether the benefits are, whether the premiums are fair in relation to the benefits charged. And that is part of what we do now in the individual and small group markets. So a separate issue is whether that would be beneficial for those middle-sized groups and for large groups. Again, large groups tend to have bargaining power, so rate regulation may be less necessary. For the middle-sized groups, they have less bargaining power. They do have some ability to shop because we do have a competitive market, as Joel said, but their individual bargaining power is less. And in some regions of the state, there are not multiple choices available to them, or is not as many choices available to them. So that's those are the public policy considerations, at least some of them, with respect to whether to extend rate regulation. And then one of the other factors, and that also comes up in our recommendations, is what should we be regulating on the basis of? That is, what's the standard on which we should be regulating rates? And right now, as we mentioned, it's an actuarial standard, and it's based primarily on projected trend. It doesn't look backwards towards surplus in the past. It doesn't look backwards toward profitability, in other words, and it doesn't look at investment earnings, incidentally. So our first recommendation is that those factors should explicitly be added to the rate review. We should be able to look at profitability when we look at rates. Now, we obviously look at lack of profitability when we look at rates, because if we have an insurance company that is getting below those appropriate levels of surplus, they must raise rates in order to stay in business. So losses at some level do get factored in, and we believe it's appropriate to factor in the profitability as well. Will this be, and that's our first recommendation, would this mean a huge change? No, it would not.
We are going to hear more about this, I'm sure, before we're done representing this.
I'm sure we will. Sure. Thank you, Corey.
So, anyway, that is our first recommendation, is, in fact, to expand the rating factors. The second recommendation is to make the rate filings public. And right now they are confidential. And we believe making them public would have several benefits. One of them is it would lift the veil of secrecy. If people want to know, well, is it a black box? The answer would be we can make it not a black box. Secondly, it would allow for a greater public scrutiny. We believe we do a good job on rate regulation, but we can benefit, we believe, also from other people's views, and it would allow people who want to comment on the appropriateness of rate review to do that with information available to them. And thirdly, we actually believe it would promote competition. Now, that's an issue on which you may hear otherwise from the insurance industry, but to the extent that there's innovations, we think it's good to have the market move quickly. They tend to see each other's innovations and benefit from the good ones rapidly now, and we think that we don't believe it would harm competition. We believe it would help competition, although we do recommend a carve-out for legitimate areas where the insurer can make a good case that revealing a particular portion of a rate filing would harm competition. So that's the second of our recommendations. The third recommendation, we have talked. Well, actually, Joel, why don't
the
you?
The bill's just, in on your recommendation.
The third recommendation is not actually. An area where we would not like to see changes in the law, but we believe you may see proposals to change the law. And in the interest of time, I think I'm just going to move through these very quickly. This is an area involving association plans. And one of the things that small employers can do now, and it's a perfectly legitimate thing for them to do, is to buy insurance through an association that they're a member of. Those are large group plans, actually. The association is a large group of an aggregated group, and they can buy a large group individually negotiated plan. What we don't want to see happening is for that association to buy a large group policy and then split up the cost for its individual small group members based on their health status or their claim status. We think that would subvert the small group community pooling rules. So we have put out a bulletin saying that we do not believe that Oregon law allows that currently, because it allows cherry picking. It allows the association to keep the good risks and have the bad risks go into the larger pool and make the large pool more expensive. So we do believe there may be legislation coming forward. We have an effective date on our bulletin of July 1st, 2007, so you may see proposals to change the law prior to that effective date. We talked about our fourth recommendation, which is to expand the rate regulation to the 26 to 50 size group. Our fifth recommendation you're going to hear about in the bill, so we'll skip over that. And then our sixth and seventh recommendations relate to some of what we just talked about. The recommendation number six is to promote some of those cost control practices that we're hearing about from insurers. And as a first step, what we would suggest is requiring insurers to file reports about what they are doing in the area of cost control. And we think that purchasers should be able to shop for health insurance, not just on the basis of the price and the benefits, but also what their insurance company is doing to help keep costs down and to make smart decisions. So having some standardized reporting to us about what insurers would do or are doing, it promotes their best practices and it gives more information to consumers. So at a minimum, we think that that is something we would like to move forward with. The final recommendation is actually to look at whether there are barriers in our current regulatory structure to promotion of long-term wellness. And I'll just give you an example. People do shop for health insurance. We mentioned that it's a competitive market. If we have individuals or small groups regularly switching from carrier to carrier, a good argument can be made that that carrier doesn't have a lot of incentive to invest in keeping the employees healthy for the long term. Now, I think insurance carriers would say, actually, we do have those incentives right now, and we've talked about some of what they're doing. But nevertheless, if there's a way we can help with that, one example might be longevity credits. We have those in car insurance, for example. You actually get a discount if you've been with your car insurance company for a long time. Well, would it make sense to say if you stay with the same health insurance company for a long time so that they have a reason to invest in your long-term health, should that be something we can take into account in rating? There's probably a number of other ideas in this area, and our recommendation is to start the discussion of what those ideas should be. So, Mr. Chair, that's the very quick summary of our recommendations. They are, we think, modest recommendations, and we know there will be plenty more.
And they are on the note. They are in your testimony that you have in front of you. Thank you very much. That's been a wonderful run-through in such a short time. We really do appreciate it, and as individual and as a committee, we likely will be back to ask some more questions as these things come to us in one form or another.
Thank you.
I will close the informational hearing on the state of health insurance in Oregon. You can stay right there if you're going to stay there. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2213, which has come to us on your behalf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we're pleased to be here to testify on House Bill 2213, which is a priority bill for the governor promoting transparency in health care, and in particular for this bill, transparency in health insurance. And Joel's going to provide testimony on the bill, and then we'll both be happy to answer any questions that you've got.
Sure. Excuse me, I'm a little new at this job. Let me ask our committee administrator to review HB 2213 for us.
And briefly, Chair, and we do have the experts in front of us here as well. This does, 2213 is recommendation number five in the report. Does several things. One is it does require that health insurers establish a procedure for disclosing the costs of benefits or procedures and services to those enrollees, such things as deductibles, coinsurance, and cost sharing. But it does require that the insurers do this in advance of those procedures and services. It does allow the insurance division to establish rules about which procedures these are applicable to, and requires then that by rule that insurers also set up a standard method for determining usual, customary, and reasonable amounts. And then it does require these same insurers to use that standard, and it's referred to as UCR, or usual customary reasonable amounts, to use that method to calculate payments when there's not a pricing agreement with the provider. And this, again, comes out of a report, according to the department, they had about 167 complaints on UCR between 2002 and 2006. And again, the HIRAC, or Health Insurance Insurance Reform Advisory Committee, did look at hospital transparency as well as health insurance transparency over this last interim. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, sir. I'm sorry, Director. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we are happy to be here to testify on this bill, which is a priority for us. And I should say, I'll just set the stage briefly. We hear, because this ties into what we have just been talking about with this report, we hear from a number of health insurers that one of the reasons they actually promote more cost sharing in health insurance is because they want us as consumers of healthcare services to make good decisions. One of the phrases you might hear is the consumer, the patient should have skin in the game and make decisions that are based on quality outcomes and cost effectiveness. And whether or not that's philosophically where your heart is, one thing that we can be sure of is it doesn't work if you can't find out what it costs. And so that fundamental issue of if you want to make a choice about where to have a procedure done, or a choice between treatment options, or even whether to have a procedure done at all, and part of your thought process is going to be how much is it going to cost me, you need to be able to know how much it's going to cost you. So, Joel, with that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, again, for the record, my name is Dorario, the Administrator with the Insurance Division with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. As Corey mentioned, it's a priority for the Governor, both at the macro level, because transparency is an important aspect of making the health system more competitive and more accountable to the public. You don't have to get very far into insurance when you call up somebody and say, what is the price of a service? And they say, tell me who your insurer is, to figure out that the pricing systems aren't necessarily very rational. They're all bifurcated and depends on which payer and which circumstance. So at the macro level, transparency is very important to making our system more competitive and accountable. And as Rick mentioned, it's also important to the individual consumer, because as consumers are being encouraged and in some cases forced to have more skin in the game, as Corey says, they ask these questions, and then they call us and say, we can't get the information we need, what's going on here. And sometimes even our trained advocates can't get the information they need, particularly when it's an out-of-network type of service. So this bill is very timely, we think, to make the process more transparent and let the consumer have some basic information on a timely basis about the kind of health care procedures that they may be considering having. And again, the key here is timely, before the service is incurred. Insurance companies obviously do have to come up with the price and the cost to the consumer after the service is incurred. So this does happen in the current system. I mean, somebody figures out how much the consumer owes. We need it to happen before the service is incurred, not afterwards. And I would have to say, in a little bit of defense of the insurers here, that if you looked at their web pages today and the kind of information that's up there about pricing and different services and encouraging people to be savvy shoppers, it's light years ahead of where it was 5 years ago. But it is still light years behind where it needs to be in terms of the market and in terms of really having consumers understand the way healthcare services are priced.
I think they'll be defending themselves in a few minutes. You don't
okay. The bill, and we've, by the way, proposed some amendments. We've been in a lot of discussion of this bill with the insurers, with the consumers, with the providers. And we're prepared to have more if we need to. So the bill that you have in front of you that I'm going to be talking to today is the conceptual amendments that are attached to my testimony. And those amendments have three basic parts. The first part deals with services that are provided within the insurer's network. And that's the easiest part of the problem, we think, to address, because there the insurer has set a price. They've negotiated a price with the provider And so they know exactly what they're going to owe their provider, and they know exactly what the consumer's cost-sharing obligations are. And so if the consumer can tell the carrier, here's my plan policy number, here's the service I want, here's the provider I want to go to, those three basic pieces of data, the insurer should be able to tell them, here would be your share of the cost if you went through that procedure. Now, it's going to come with caveats. It's always what we're asking for here is a reasonable estimate, not an absolute number, because there can be unexpected complications in the service. There may be inaccurate information provided. The point is that there should be a reasonable estimate. And then if it changes later, the insurer should be held accountable for, was the estimate reasonable, and can you explain what it was that happened that changed the estimate? And in a lot of cases, again, that's going to happen. So our touchstone here is for in-network services where they've negotiated the price, there ought to be a reasonable estimate made when the consumer contacts them with the information about their plan and their the service they want to have and the provider they want to have. The second issue with that part of the bill is what procedures should this apply to. It's probably not sensible to start with saying do this for every service under a state mandate. So we propose in the bill that be a rulemaking function for us to determine what services. You may hear that some of those things should be put in the bill. The reason we propose it for the department is because I think today what services are most important may not be the services that are most important 2 years from now. The market's moving rather quickly, so to have more flexibility in terms of specifying, we'd go after the most common procedures in that part of the bill by rule, we think makes the most sense. The second part of the bill, which is a little more complicated, is out-of-network services. So this is where the insurance carrier does not have a contract with the provider. There's no set price to start with. And so you have the insurer, then initially the provider setting a price, their so-called bill charge. That's what they would like to receive for the service. To make sure that there's some discipline, pricing discipline in the system, we do allow insurers today to look at that price against the usual, customary, and reasonable measure. That's the terminology of the statute, usual, customary, and reasonable. So they can say, you're asking for a $100 bill. We think the standard, which most providers in this community ask for, the UCR standard is $80. So insurers are only going to agree to pay $80. Now, here's where the consumer gets confused, because they read their contract and they say it's a $100 bill, and my contract says out of network I get paid 50%. So I think I'm getting $50 on that contract. Then the insurer says, well, actually not, because our UCR on that is only 80, so you get 50% of 80, so you're going to get $40. So now the consumer thinking they had to pay 50, if they have to pay the full amount, they're going to pay they'll pay $60 under that contract. You're going to hear today about the complexity of that situation and how best to address it. Sometimes the consumer gets stuck with that extra charge if the carrier says we're only paying 80, they can justify it, and then provider wants 100, they would have the right to collect that other $20 from the consumer directly. And then other people get involved. So that's the part that gets complicated. Originally under the bill, if you had read the bill as we originally filed it, we said we want to cut through all that and have a standardized price for a standardized way to do UCR. So all carriers would do it the same way. It would be a clear-cut system. But if you think about that against the fact that, assuming we don't regulate the price that providers charge up here, standardizing what the insurer does is going to leave the consumer vulnerable on the difference between those two. So assuming again, and legislature could decide to regulate those prices, but that'd be a pretty complicated thing to do, standardizing the UCR will simply leave the consumer vulnerable to what the provider charges above and beyond that standard. So what we've proposed instead in our amendments today is to say the process has to be clear to the consumer. There has to be, we have to see these UCR, we already do see them, by the way, and we disapprove certain ways of calculating UCR that we don't think are reasonable. But increasingly, carriers are using third-party models. They hire a vendor, the Eugenics is a common one, to set those UCRs. And when our advocates call up and say, well, how did you get to that UCR? That seems pretty low. It seems, that would bill us $2,000, and you're saying the usual and customary is only $1,000, that seems pretty low. The carriers have a difficult time explaining the system. Well, we rely on a third-party vendor. So we, in the bill, propose that we have better regulatory authority to go in and look at those third-party models and make sure that those are reasonable and approve a reasonable UCR methodology. And then the second part of this for the consumer would be that we have authority by rule to set a standard format for which the carrier discloses that UCR calculation, so the consumer can understand ahead of time on our network service how the UCR is going to be calculated and what it might be for a particular service.
At the moment, we only have the bill in front of us, right? We don't have a set of amendments.
The conceptual amendments, Mr. Chair, are attached to the testimony, but you're right. You have the bill in front of you.
Right.
So that's how we propose today to handle that standardization. Again, I think that most of the testimony today from the providers and insurers will be around that set of issues. The third part of the bill is to give us rulemaking authority.
Excuse me a moment. If you need conversations, it'd be handy to take them outside. I'm sorry, Mr. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The third part of the bill is around our rulemaking authority, and this, again, is a question for the committee. What should be part of the statute? What should be part of the rules? That's always the kind of public policy call that the legislature needs to make. In this case, we propose three things, essentially, that be left to rule. One is to define the particular procedures that are going to be the subject of these responsibilities, and we'd focus on the most common procedures initially. Second thing is that we have this strengthening authority over the way in which the usual and customary and reasonable charges are calculated. And the third piece would be that we can mandate a standardized way to disclose those UCR charges so that consumers can understand them. So those are the basics of the bill. Some of this that are in the conceptual amendments is in response to discussions with various of the stakeholders that has not been on the street, so to speak, for more than about a week. So we're happy if it's the wish of the committee to engage in further discussions. I think that you'll hear some proposals to that effect. But we also think what we've proposed today is reasonable and will work based on the discussions we've had. And with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, let's head.
And Corey, one of the concerns I've been around the building a long time, and it's always been a concern to lawmakers that they may pass a bill that looks one way when they leave the building, and then by the time the agency is finished with it, the administrative rules look nothing like the bill that was currently passed. Would you address that? And could you give us assurance that if we moved the bill and did all this, that your administrative rules would look and be in line with basically whatever product, if the product comes out, what that looks like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, that is always our intent, and I believe we achieve it. One of the things that we try to do is, during the legislative process, work closely with the range of stakeholder groups so that the bill reflects what everybody is expecting to happen in the rulemaking, and then we actually tend to work very closely with those same stakeholder groups in the rulemaking process. Now, it is often a challenge, I will tell you, because sometimes the legislature chooses to leave some difficult issues for the rulemaking process more or less on purpose, because it's sometimes just an easier way for the parties to slug it out, if you will. So there are situations where the bill comes out with specific issues purposely unresolved and left to us. But we generally, our goal is to have you fully recognize the rules as carrying out what you do when you vote on the bill. And what we try to do then in this process is answer those questions and make sure we have that clear understanding. If there are specific areas in this proposal that you're concerned about, we would be happy to address them either now or later.
No, I haven't had an opportunity to review this, but I was just, that has been a long-standing concern, because it does happen quite often that you might pass a bill, and it's not always that we'd say, okay, well, we'll let the agency figure out what the rules are. Sometimes it's a shock and awe that we look at this and go, oh my God, this is nothing like we passed, and they have implemented rules that basically gut the legislation. So there would be, I think, considerable concern about that.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, I would love to have that conversation with you if you're aware of any of those situations in my agency.
I didn't say anything to your agency.
No, I understand. I absolutely understand that. What I'm trying to say is that we want those issues brought to our attention if anybody does have concerns. That's one of the requests I would make of you, actually, is if you see us going in a direction that doesn't represent legislative intent in any of our rulemakings, please let us know.
Thank you.
Representative Vice Chair, and then Representative Cannon next.
Mr. Chair, kind of a comment. This goes, the bill is focusing on transparency of what an insured would have to pay as part of a procedure. The problem goes far beyond that, in that, just a very brief story, I have a daughter who she was pregnant, so she went into the hospital to get an ultrasound, and she said, how much is it going to be? And they said something like $360. She said, great. She pulls out her checkbook, and they said, oh, you're not insured? It'll be $448. And she couldn't understand how come somebody's going to pay immediately would have to pay so much more than someone who's insured. The whole transparency issue is
I'm
going
to assure you that if she goes to negotiate, she'll get to $360.
Well, this was a while back. But the point is that there needs to be transparency for consumers generally. And so I hope that as our committee proceeds, that we not just watch for transparency of insureds with insurance carriers, but also for consumers generally, so that anyone can go and find out whether, you know, just roughly what it's going to cost for them to go to one practitioner versus another, or for one hospital as compared to another.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, just on that very point, we have another transparency initiative, which is to augment what the hospitals currently provide on their webpage, which is that bill charge. That's the $448 charge, which almost nobody does pay. They do negotiate it down. We want to augment that with data on what insurers actually negotiate as their discounts against those hospital rates. The insurers have provided us with all of their claims data for a given period of time, and we are in the process of aggregating that, and then we can disclose to the public what the average discounted rate is for each of those hospital services, what a commercial insured patient will pay, which is a much more realistic number for the market. So you're absolutely right. Transparency is a very broad topic. This is dealing with just one chunk of it, but all these other dimensions are important, too.
That would be helpful.
I suspect we're going to hear those, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a specific question about the bill and the amendments that you've proposed, but it actually gets, I think, to a similar issue. So this is for clarification. The bill and the amendments, the concept amendments that you have, would they apply an obligation to the insurer to provide, disclose information to the consumer? Does the provider incur any obligations under this proposal, or are they out of the picture altogether?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, very good question. Under this bill, we focus on the entities that we regulate, which are the insurers, which for in-network is really all you need to work with, is because they have a set price and they can tell you what you pay, and the provider, what the insurer and the provider have negotiated, isn't going to affect the consumer's direct payment. On the out-of-network side, that's the issue that comes up. We don't now regulate, neither we do nor does any other state entity regulate the provider prices. And so disclosure on the provider side, I think, would help here, but who exactly would be responsible for that, how it would work, is part of the complexity we face on the out-of-network side, and you may hear more on that from other witnesses.
If I could just follow up for a minute.
Please do.
I mean, I'm just trying to understand how this would work from a consumer's point of view, and I understand that as consumers, many of us have become used to managed care models or working with our insurers to understand what care we can get and what we'll have to pay for it. But at the same time, as a consumer of healthcare, my primary interaction is with my physician, and the physician under this and their assistants aren't obligated to disclose information about cost, because that comes through the insurer, and I think it's a complicated set of interactions that the consumer has to go through, perhaps by phone, to get the actual price from the insurer. And I'm just still working through my own understanding of this, but I'd make that comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, it's a very challenging problem because often the provider, the doctor in whose office you're sitting, has no idea. the doctor just is totally separated from the billing and the charging process. And in fact, for anything that involves more than just sitting and talking to your doctor, there are probably a multiplicity of charges. There may be the lab charge, there may be the charge for the inoculation, there may be the anesthetist, there may be, and so even if you were able to get somebody to tell you a price, it wouldn't necessarily be the price that you will pay. The example that you gave of
I think it's time to maybe move this on because we have a bunch of people waiting to testify.
And just a quick question, Chair Greenleaf.
Yes, and a quick answer to follow.
Yeah, and it's just a more of a grammar thing than anything. But in the second phrase, and then I guess on line 31 on page 4, the term is the director shall specify the procedures. I'm just kind of surprised that this bill states the director versus the organization. That's a heavy responsibility.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, because we don't have a governing commission, all of our authorizing statutes actually are stated in terms of the director.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the hour and a half. It's been very useful. It's been a very useful time. I very much appreciate it.
Happy to come back.
We have about 7 witnesses who'd like to testify. Maybe we can start with Scott Gallant and Bruce Bishop. Join us up front. They're used to sitting side by side. The odd couple.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am his bodyguard. For the record, I'm Scott Gallant. I'm the Associate Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Association. And we have briefly reviewed the amendments, which I believe were available about a week ago. A couple of comments that your committee has made are very critical. The Medical Association does not want the patient to be confused about what they believe their actual obligation is if they get information that may not be reliable, because the physician is likely to be blamed or accused of billing more than they should. And there are a number of different elements on how physician payment occurs that typically reduces the amount that they actually get paid. And I'll provide the committee with some definitions and explanations in writing, hopefully next week, but that I think are very critical. The comment that often the physician does not know what he or she will be paid is true. And there is also another area to make this even more confusing. There are brokers or plans who sell physician panels. These are typically non-risk PPO type models. And have further discounts. The physician may not know that this patient is on one of those plans. They have never received any real information about it. And they wouldn't be able to tell you what the patient was obligated to deal with. And that is totally unregulated in this process. I think that the concept, and the Medical Association believes the concept of transparency is very important. We also believe that physicians need to be able to receive better information, more disclosure from insurers on what they actually are going to be paid in order to be able to more appropriately contract and provide services. So we are, I believe, Mr. Chairman, the rumor has circulated that there might be a work group to look at these amendments, and I would very much appreciate being included in that to work on this legislation, which I think needs some more work. Thank you.
In response to that rumor, if I can speed up testimony, it is my intention to name a work group when we're done today, and we will move this forward at that point.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. When I signed up at 3 o'clock, I intended to talk about House Bill 2213 with a set of amendments that I had received that were being circulated as conceptual amendments. I believe the amendments that you received within the last 20 minutes or so as attachments to the testimony are different than the version of the amendments, so I'm in no position to comment either at this point on the bill or on the conceptual amendments that have been furnished to you as part of the testimony. What I would like to say on behalf of the Hospital Association is that if you read the summary of the bill as printed, we support that summary. If you read the editor's note that precedes that summary, it says that it's an editor's brief statement of the essential features of the measure as introduced. And I don't know how we can go beyond that because I don't really know what this bill is anymore.
Well, the bill we have in front of us is 2213.
Did you see those amendments?
Well, I have, but we don't have those amendments in front of us. So.
And, Mr. Chair, if we're testifying on the bill in front of you, we support the general disclosure of information as described in the bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions of either OMA or OAHHS? Thank you very much for testifying.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I assume the Hospital Association would be interested in being a part of the statement with me.
If we could, please.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Thank you.
We have, perhaps we can get four people up, if we can get a panel. Elise Brow, Dave Fiskum, Jim Gravett, and John Powell. Is there room for everybody? You can take another chair if you want.
Switch out.
Okay. They've deserted you.
I'm all alone. Yeah. They're hooked together. Jim chairs us.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Elise Brown representing America's Health Insurance Plans, which is the national trade association representing nearly 1,300 private sector companies providing health insurance coverage to more than 200 million Americans. And we just now received a minute or two ago the same amendment. So I'm going to be providing some very general comments by way of introduction, and we'll let you hear more from some of AHIP's Oregon members. And I have to drive about 75 miles an hour up to Portland to hop a plane here shortly, so I am going to be brief, and I apologize for that. AHIP and its Oregon members are strong.
As a health committee, we're not going to sanction that.
I'll be as careful as possible. AHIP and its Oregon members are strong supporters of providing consumers meaningful information relative to health care costs and quality. And we've been working with the insurance division to ensure an end result that will do three things for the consumer, and that would be to provide timely, useful, and relevant information as consumers consider treatment decisions with their doctors. The division has also stated that their overarching goal of this transparency initiative is to require insurers to provide consumers with a baseline of cost information, frame of reference, to understand average potential liability. We all share the same end goal, but we cannot support 2213 today in its current form or the amendments, but we do look forward to the opportunity to reach consensus on how we get there. One thing I wanted to point out before I leave today, and it's important that you know that there are transparency tools on the ground now that exist today that are being used by consumers over the Internet. And I want to share, this is just one example from one of AHIP's Oregon members, and by no means is considered the standard. But United Healthcare has developed an innovative consumer tool that they refer to as treatment cost estimator. It gives their members an opportunity to search 850 conditions, procedures, tests, and drugs that provides cost information based on your zip code and other zip codes depending on the region. And the purpose of that is what we're after. It shows what the out-of-pocket costs will be for the member in-network. Another cost comparison tool is hospital cost comparison tool, which allows members to compare hospitals in their area by certain procedures and diagnosis based on four key measures that the member ranks in order of importance: number of patients, average length of stay, percentage of complications, and patient mortality. 165 of these procedures and diagnoses are available on this tool. And again, those are just a couple of examples, but I wanted to point those out just to demonstrate that the commitment that carriers have to working hard to improve the capabilities for their consumers to get that information. But I also want to say, too, that if we're not careful and thoughtful about how we get there, that legislation like 2213 can have some unintended consequences and will stifle innovation and confuse members, and ultimately raising costs in the end. To build the technology needed for the detailed information as prescribed in this bill to be linked and disclosed instantaneously, such as the specific allowable hospital expenses and individuals' specific deductible, coinsurance, and out-of-pocket maximums, that would be fantastic. But it's not achievable in the short term and would not come without a price tag. If the goal is to provide this information via the Internet, and there isn't a reasonable implementation timeline right now in the bill, significant technological advancements will need to be made, which is going to bump the cost up and possibly present affordability and access barriers to coverage. The industry has developed a proposal that we believe will meet the goals of providing consumers with greater access to healthcare costs, estimates prior to receiving care so that they can consider the very best information in determining the very best appropriate course they want to take and do so without adding the administrative costs. We do look forward to continuing our discussions with the division, purchasing community, and all others to deliver a product that in the end consumers want and they will use. So with that, I will turn that over and let you hear from Jim Gravett, Pacific Source, and we have Dave Fiskum representing United Healthcare, and John Powell with Regents. And pardon me, but I have to...
Well, excuse you, I'm gonna drive carefully.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Jim Gravett, Pacific Source Health Plans. I'm not going to read anything because I just broke my reading glasses, so... I think Elise covered most of the major points, and it was referred that we had an example here of an ultrasound and the price that was given for an ultrasound. And an ultrasound lends itself to pricing, but other procedures, and basically I'm trying to point out how complicated this whole thing would be to try and reach the goals of 2213, not that we wouldn't like to. But some of the procedures that we're talking about, one of the more common procedures would be the cost of a normal, uncomplicated delivery. We ran some analysis just to see how those figures would come out, what we would be able to tell somebody what their out-of-pocket costs might be. And we took the analysis over a six-month period from January 1, 2006 through June. And we found that there's a range of costs, and these are prices we've contracted for. And because each case is unique, we found that our range, and we show a distribution here, I have examples I can leave, range from $1,500 to $18,500. So it would really make a difference where how complicated or what kind of services, if things got complicated down the line, what services would be needed and what we would be billed for. Now, Joel had mentioned earlier that...
Excuse me, can I interrupt?
Sure, yes.
You had the range for a normal, uncomplicated, spontaneous delivery? I mean, could you have that range? That wouldn't be between 1,800...
That's what our data... Now, we show a distribution chart, and probably the majority of the people fall somewhere between 4,000 and 4,500. But we certainly have cases that have hit the $18,500.
That's an uncomplicated delivery?
That is
$1,000?
No.
Well, the delivery itself may have been uncomplicated at the time, and to tell you the truth, I don't know what all goes into these things. But the hospital stay itself and all the other items needed during that hospital stay, that was the total price we got on that case.
But you could have said 80% of the cases were between $4,000 and $4,500.
Occasionally,
there can be problems that might drive it as high as...
And that's the point I'm making, is that, yes, we can say we have an average here, or that 80% of the cases are at $4,000 or $4,500. But to be able to tell a specific individual what their out-of-pocket would be because of the unknowns would be fairly complicated. And it could be confusing to the patient. Let's see, I was going to make a point. Joel mentioned that carriers have a contract for a price for a procedure with the specific providers. A lot of times that contract is percentage of charges. So in other words, we're paying a percentage of what the hospital would normally charge, not one set price. So there again, it kind of complicates the issue of trying to come up with a specific amount in these cases. And that's why I think Lisa's alternative to come up with some standards or averages to give those people an idea of what their out-of-pocket expense potentially could be would probably be a little closer to achieving the transparency than what we have in the bill here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you guys have a website?
Madam Representative, yes, we do. We have some examples, or we did have some examples. I think they're being redone of what some procedures, the range of costs that some procedures might cost. Now, that doesn't give the member the information of what percentage he might have to pay, he or she might have to pay, as far as co-insurance, co-payments, and so forth. But it does give a range of costs of I think there's 6 to 12 procedures that we've listed.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And then I'll be quiet. Do you let your patients or your customers know that there is a website, and do you educate them where they can go if they need to have a question on pricing?
Madam Representative, yes, we do.
Okay.
We provide this information in the benefit books that we provide employers to hand out to their employees with regard to describing their benefits. We tell them how to get to that on several pages of the benefit book. We also send out annual letters to members, including that information, how to get to the website. We have programs that we call In Touch, where it's called an In Touch program, where members can access their specific account and find out what deductibles they have satisfied at this point, so forth and so on. So those tools are there, and yes, we are trying to get that information out to them.
Thank you.
I'd like to comment. I think your point is life is complicated. That's something I learned a long time ago, so I appreciate you reinforcing my opinion on that. But I talked to a person who's relatively sophisticated. They were going to have a knee surgery, and they had to pay 15% copay on their knee surgery. And the doctor said, you can go to hospital A or you can go to hospital B. And it doesn't matter to me. They're both good hospitals. And the person was skin in the game, in this case, the skin of the knee, which I have some sympathy for, wanted to find out which hospital would be less expensive since they were paying 15% of it. And they called their insurance company and could not get, a relatively sophisticated person with an advanced degree in health administration, could not get the information they needed to know whether it would cost them more to go to hospital A or hospital B. The insurance company refused to give them that information. Now, that person would have been very well satisfied to say, at hospital B, 80% of the cases for this were between this amount, and at hospital B, 80% of the cases were between this amount and this amount. That's all we needed. And that kind of information you have available there.
And I think
the question is, let's figure out how to get that kind of information.
And I think that's the direction we need to move.
Exactly.
Yeah. Certainly.
Chair Greenlee, just one last comment for on the record. I don't know if your communications on the internet are in multiple languages of at least half a dozen countries in this world, but as a state representative that has a minimum of 5 to 10 different speaking languages in my district, you know, I'd hope that that's always a consideration.
Yeah, Madam Representative.
Russian,
yes. Mr.
Well,
Chair,
Russian is
the big language.
It is a big Russian community.
It's sounding better all the time.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative. and that is certainly a concern, and we do employ a translation service where we can deal with Russian, Spanish, and those, but obviously getting stuff like that into print or electronically is a little more difficult. I think we do have our information in Spanish.
Follow-up, sir?
Sure. Mr. Fiske and Mr. Polk,
I know.
Can we get into the batter's box here?
Last comment.
Be on deck here.
Yeah, we in schools have been dealing with this for a long time. We can help you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
And this is
Representative Mao.
This is kind of a comment. First off, I got a couple issues, and one is the privacy when you deal with individual plans and deductibles and what their coinsurance is, and this is just a general statement. I'm not looking at anybody in particular. And so privacy becomes an issue. So you're going to end up with a username and password if you're dealing with somebody's deductible and where they are in that whole process to get real-time information, which I think is a pretty significant hurdle. Another issue is that providers need to have access to this information because in many cases the providers are the ones that are really the interpreter for this whole process. And so somehow the provider needs to be brought into the fold because we make decisions every day in our clinic for the clients in conversation with them, and we try to go through this process because it is important about how much it costs. And we can't get that information. It's absolutely brutal. But it's most of the time it's the simple stuff. It's not the major. Yeah. And last but not least is that we've got a system that's really been built out of a function of how we pay for it, and that we need to get over the hurdle of well, we can't get there today because the system is going to change whether we want it to or not, and that we're going to have to adapt to these new changes. So that's just my comment.
Thank you. Gentlemen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dave Fiskin here, representing Pacific Care, United Healthcare, insured in Oregon. It covers approximately 170,000 lives in the individual, small, and large group, and senior citizen markets. I'll try to be brief because, Mr. Chair, we appreciate your intent, as you've expressed, to form a work group and to work out the details here, but I think it's important to just make a few comments for the record. One of the things I did in thinking about transparency legislation, which on behalf of clients I've dealt with now for several sessions, is I tried to write down for me, as well as my clients, the principles that motivated our interest in this subject, and we do have interest in this subject. First, and I'm just going to read these very quickly to you, but it's very important for the record to say these things, at least for my clients. Increased transparency is a laudable goal for all involved in healthcare delivery, including insurers and providers. Increased transparency should provide real information to consumers, and it's easy to confuse them. The discussion we've had today about complexity illustrates that. Increased transparency is such a laudable goal that new standards should be reached by a consensus effort on the part of all groups. And all groups, to me, means legislators, regulators, insurers, providers, especially hospitals, and consumers, doctors as well, and I don't mean to leave them out. I hope you recognize another principle. Existing commitments to transparency are being taken and, in fact, have been taken at the initiative of insurers and providers. The hospital website that you heard about is one example of that. The United Healthcare website that Elise Brown mentioned is another example. And everybody has that stuff, that kind of information where they're trying to respond to customers. After all, we have customers, and we're in the business of serving them, and we need to do a better job. But we have made some progress. we must guard against releasing, and Mr. Ario said this at one point, or perhaps it was Ms. Streisinger, the unintended release of proprietary information that can, in fact, harm competition if it is to be released. We need to look at that. And then care should be taken that transparency standards aren't imposed in a way that increases administrative costs. And that's also easy to do. In the spirit of doing better with transparency, we can't increase costs. We're in favor of transparency. We want to work with you to produce it. We had some comments about amendments that were circulated last Friday to us. They've gone out to my clients so they can vet them from the standpoint of experts, and we now have a new set today, and we'll get those out as quick as we can so we get comments back, Mr. Chair, and so we can work with you to produce a final product for your consideration this session. I'll stop there. My last point, I think, is just quickly critical. I'm unaware of another state which has done this. Embarking on a quest to pass legislation such as this, and if there's one, somebody can point it out to me, but we're at least among a very small group that have tried this, and that makes it even more critical for us, the collective us, to get it right. I would encourage your involvement, Matt, to lead us in that effort, and we'll participate. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and you should know that just before we came up here, he asked me if we should say anything. Now, give me a break.
Say anything, so you don't have to.
Oh, Dave, you wore me out just listening. Mr. Chairman, Regents is committed to transparency. Some of my colleagues in this building left knots on my head toward the end of last session because of our belief in transparency. And we will, as the others here, work hard on this. We're proud of our, what is in Regents terms, called the engine on the Internet, which has an awful lot of information for consumers and for our members. We look forward to improving that. When Representative Richardson asked where our surplus goes, part of it will go toward this effort and building a more sophisticated program. As Mr. Fiskum pointed out, there are some impediments, and perhaps one of the reasons the person on the other end of the line, that sophisticated person, could not give them cost information about two hospitals may have been contracts they have with those two facilities that prohibit the release of certain information. So there are a lot of barriers. We're for breaking them down. We're for consumers knowing and being able to choose where they get their care and knowing what it's going to cost.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am. Can I just interrupt for a moment? I'd like to introduce one of our newest elected officials in the county. Washington County Commissioner Desiree Strader in the back with one of Representative Bonamici's newest constituents, Gabrielle. Yeah. Welcome, Desiree. Excuse me.
Could Representative Greenlick's constituent call the hospital and gotten a price rather than trying to go to the insurance company?
No, they tried that. The hospital said they have a different deal depending on the insurance company, and they didn't know what the deal was. At least it's probably an insurance company.
Fascinating.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis, one of the things I was, you'll be surprised to know, taught as a lobbyist was, well, I don't know the answer to tell you, and I don't know the answer. So I'll leave it at that. I can find out the answer.
Is Bruce
it might depend, and if Mr. Bishop is here, maybe he knows, but that's not to trap him. I think it's a question we ought to answer, and I don't know the answer today.
If somebody would interrupt Mr. Bishop and ask him whether he'd like to come forward and answer that question.
Did you hear the question?
The question was, if they can't get the information from the insurance company, the person I talked to, could they get that information from the hospital about what to expect?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Hospitals are a very important part of the delivery system, but they are not responsible for all of the services that a patient would receive. So we don't necessarily have the ability to provide all of that information to a patient or to a prospective patient in advance. We may not know what the physician charges will be, for example, what the charges for anesthesia will be. So we have a component of the cost and a significant component of the cost, but we're not responsible for all of the costs that a patient might incur.
But could they say, well, this is an average? I mean, could they give them a range?
Mr. Chair, Representative Minnis.
This is our portion?
In fact, hospitals nearly 2 years ago did voluntarily disclose price information statewide by diagnostic group so that consumers can go online and look at that information in an aggregated basis. So, yes, that information is available. It may not tell you as a patient what your costs are going to be for a specific procedure, but it will tell you relatively what the costs are, what the prices are on average for a service. And that information is available already.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? We have one more witness signed up, Laura Etherton. Can you join us, please? We need to move quickly because we are adjourning this subcommittee to move any members who are able to join the Senate Committee on Health Care, whatever it is.
Reform?
On health care reform, down in hearing room A. Please.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate for Oregon State Public Interest Research Group for OSPIRG. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding House Bill 2213, and I will try to make it very brief. Oregonians are facing steeply rising health care costs, paying not only skyrocketing prescription drug costs and increasing premiums, as you've heard, but also increasing copays, co-insurance, deductibles. Consumers surely do have skin in the game. Consumers are shouldering more and more of the burden of the cost of health care, but too often are unable to obtain even the most basic information about cost and quality when they are making decisions about treatment. House Bill 2213 takes an important first step forward to increase cost transparency by giving insured consumers the right to know the cost, or at least an estimate of the cost, that they will bear for a specific treatment. This disclosure is important across the board, but is especially critical when a consumer is facing a significant procedure and when coinsurance is involved. A consumer facing a 15 or 20% coinsurance rate for a very expensive procedure in the tens of thousands is facing a significant outlay of cash. They should be able to find out about that in advance for planning purposes and in order to be able to shop around to the extent possible given their health condition for the best value. We're also interested in the bill's efforts to establish some sort of standard method for calculating the usual and customary and reasonable costs for out-of-network providers, and potentially either to establish that or to at least disclose how that is established to consumers. Because of increased cost sharing, consumers are paying more and more of these costs, and similarly to the in-network providers need to know how much those will cost. And it is significant that the standard method is only really helpful for consumers if it does not result in an additional cost shift to consumers when the out-of-network provider charges more than the usual and customary amount that's been established. Thanks again for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. I encourage the committee to pass these transparency protections.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've, as I mentioned before, intend to name a work group now to work on this. You only want to do that when there is the probability of achieving consensus in a relatively rapid time, and I've been informed by various parties that it is possible in this case to achieve a consensus product. So I've asked Representative Cannon to help coordinate this. I've asked Representative Scott Bruhn from the full committee to join with him. I'd like you to get your work done within, say, 3 weeks. We're moving at a very fast pace this year. We don't have very much leisure. So if we don't get a consensus product at that time, we'll work with the bill itself and whatever amendments we have in front of us. Please, Mr. Bukovian said that he will provide staff support. I don't know, you or
Rick
or him involved in that. We need DCBS on that, the OMA, OAHHS. We need ONA, perhaps a union representative, maybe SEIU. We need somebody from the consumer advocate side and a couple of the health insurers. Ben, perhaps you and Rick can be working on that. If somebody would like to be involved, it would be great if the health insurers could tell us who you want to represent you on that, and we'll nominate a group and get it going as early as the beginning of next week if we can.
You said, what is there a Republican that's going to be on this?
Yes, Scott Bruin's going to be. Scott and Ben are the two that are going to be working to coordinate. I've already talked to Scott, and he's anxious to be involved.
Mr. Chair, wouldn't it be better if there was someone from this committee that?
Yes, that would be fine if there were somebody from this, excuse me, from the subcommittee. Something you'd like to do?
Well, or Representative Richardson probably.
Well, he and I talked about Scott. And he felt okay about me. Either way is okay with me, too.
I just think if you're going to have Ben's very skilled and he's very bright, but I think it'd be good to have a Republican member on that work group if you're not opposed to that. That's from this committee.
Well, he's from the full committee.
Bruin is
from the full committee.
We're doing the meat of the work in the
committee. We are in this case. Well, I'm certainly happy to take that advice, and we'll perhaps you can talk to Dennis and whatever Representative Richardson would like to do. We'll get back on that. No, that's fine. That's what I was trying to achieve.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2213, and adjourn. I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2213 and adjourn the Subcommittee on Healthcare Access of the House Committee on Healthcare. We'll reassemble in hearing room A for any of you that can join at that time. Good job. Thank you.